Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education, your weekly guide to education matters in Ireland and further afield. You can get in touch through Twitter at Inside Ed, by email insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie or through the programme's website insideed.com. If you're an educator with a story to tell or an event to highlight, please contact me and I'll do my best to feature it. On this week's programme, I bring you the second part of my interview with the Director of the Teaching Council, Tomás O'Rourke. Tomás has been Director of the Teaching Council since 2012, and on last week's programme he spoke about Féilte, the recent celebration of teaching organised by the Council, about continuing professional development and about research and teaching. This week he speaks about Druid, registration with the Teaching Council, fitness to teach, teacher supply and more. I began by asking Tomás to tell me what Druid is.
Druid is the Irish word for bridge, obviously. It's the title we've chosen for our new pilot model of induction probation. We chose that word both because of its meaning and because we wanted a word to have meaning. I think all too often organisations like ourselves are too fond of acronyms. You come up with a kind of name of a scheme, you have an acronym that emerges from it, and the acronym means absolutely nothing. So we deliberately chose a word that kind of a concept that meant something in relation to this transition from when you're a fully qualified teacher to when you actually go into schools and take responsibility for your own class. And I know there are some discussion around that. The concept is somewhat contested sometimes by different parties as to, you know, do you really need induction and probation? I think the majority viewpoint would tend to be that no matter what way you manage the transition, there is a world of difference between being a student teacher, even your final year, and actually working full time, taking responsibility for your own class. There has always been a very strong culture and tradition of probation in primary schools. Primary teachers will recall the reference to the dip year and being dipped by the inspectors and so on. In post-primary, you have what's called the PQA, post-PQE, I should say, post-qualification employment, that's signed off by the principal. What we're trying to bring in is a whole new, I suppose, understanding of the process. Because I think at the moment, it would be very much seen as an evaluative process based on perhaps one or two visits from the inspectors, a kind of an end point, a terminal point of assessment. And that might be somewhat unfair reflection on the inspector. I think they are coming more and more into a supportive space for teachers, but nevertheless, that's the majority perception out there. And what we're endeavouring to do is to reimagine, reconceptualise that whole process as one of support and guidance, and yes, I suppose, confirmation of readiness for full registration. So that it's about, I think as a council, in the past 2 years, we are learning from the pilot ourselves, as much as anyone else's, I hope. And then what I'm referring to there in terms of that learning is that we are beginning to reimagine the meaning of standards. The default position would tend to be standards of output. So you're dipped, you're a fully probated teacher, or your CPD is fully completed, or you are now qualified as a teacher. And it's not that we're kind of throwing that out, but trying to reorient the balance in terms of the understanding of the concept from one of standards of outputs to include an equal emphasis on standards of processes. And that comes back to the accountability agenda, I think, that was discussed at the Scotland's conference this year. But I think it's there is an understandable, I suppose, a seductive logic around accountability, verify the end point, but we're about the quality of teaching and learning for the NQT themselves, for the pupils. And I think we fundamentally believe, I think the Druid pilot is showing this, that where you have a more supportive process involving a collaborative approach, not just one teacher mentoring the NQT, but a team of colleagues mentoring the NQT, observing the NQT, and the NQT observing them, you get a much richer process of deeper learning that ultimately leads to better teaching for not just the NQT, but actually the teachers themselves who are mentoring the NQT. So an NQT, for example, in the pilot last year would have talked about, I actually feel like a professional now. Another NQT would have talked about how their planning, they knew themselves with 3 weeks of their planning that they were not on the right track. Talk to the PST, the professional support team, and said, yes, you're on the wrong track and here's how you do the planning better, and they're able to change it straight away. A fellow NQT in a different school, which is following the more traditional model of probation, had to wait 2 months to discover their planning was on the wrong track. So there's 5 weeks of better planning as a result.
And so teachers then who are participating, beginning teachers who are participating in the Druid pilot, they don't have inspections by the department inspectors.
Not right? In the same way. The inspectors are still involved, and that's an important point to make. I think some of the concerns from teachers when we were consulting about the process was a fear that the current safeguarders of standards were walking away from the process. And I think ourselves, the inspector would be equally clear they're not walking away from the process, but they'd be involved in a different way and based on a different understanding of support and guidance. So the inspector would be involved in terms of supporting clusters. The NQTs meet in clusters in the pilot. The professional support team members meet in clusters as well. and that at their request, at their invitation, this again is about the profession leading the conversation, if the profession wants the inspectors to come along to those cluster meetings, they're more than happy to do so. They're also involved if there are difficult cases where NQTs are experiencing professional difficulties. The first port of call for the support team would be to the NIPT and get extra support and guidance from the associate teachers who are part of the NIPT and say, look, can you help us help this NQT? And once those supports are exhausted, and if the NQT is still experiencing professional difficulties, then the NIPT, I think, or the principal would then approach the inspector and say, we want you to conduct a visit. Typically, we understand from the experience of probation to date, between 2 and 5% of NQTs would experience serious difficulties in the probationary process. So based on those figures, you're indicating that you would think that in a very tiny percentage of cases, that scenario could unfold. But really, apart from that, in terms of the inspector's involvement, it's a conceptually different type of involvement.
And given that Ireland is so small, and given that, you know, a principal, you know, if they're working with an NQT, they get to know them, and even if they see that there are problems, they might just be reluctant to kind of say, look, I think this teacher is actually experiencing difficulties.
Yes.
Is there a concern there that puts huge pressure on this principal who is living in a locality and mm-hmm. who maybe knows the beginning teacher's family and so on?
Mm.
How can that be addressed?
The one that was planned to address that in the pilot is through the cluster approach, whereby that if a principal or a school, be it because they're a small school and don't have a full-time administrative principal, that's a teaching principal, or for the reason you just outlined, there may be a large enough school but in a community where everybody knows everybody else and they're just simply uncomfortable making that decision, we have made scope, we provided for scope in the pilot, I should say, for external people, let's say from other schools, to sit in the professional support team of that school, or for particularly a network of teaching principal schools, that the teaching principals together would form the cluster or the team, and therefore it's not just Mr. Delaney, the principal, making a judgment or conducting the process with their own teacher. It's also Mr. Delaney and the principals in the neighbouring schools. So there is that safeguard. I think the key point to note here, however, even allowing for the external dimension in the pilot, we make no apologies for this. Everyone involved in the process of supporting and guiding the NQT must be a practicing teacher, must be a registered teacher, fresh from the classroom. Because notwithstanding the very valid issues you raised there in terms of bias and, I suppose, particularly in a kind of a small community and so on, we work from the premise that those working at the site of action and teaching and learning know best. They're not the only ones who know, but they do know best how to mediate policy in their own context. I think the DRAID framework and our interpretation of quality assurance, and it's in a paper I gave to the inspectorate conference last year, it's on our website, will be consistent with that we create the overall framework. This isn't a free-for-all and casting schools loose, as perhaps has arguably happened in England. This is an appropriate degree of autonomy and professional judgment, being free to exercise the professional judgment in their local context, but supported and guided by a robust national framework based on quality standards. And I think that the understandable mistake people might be making in that concern around the big SO, the big sign off, is seeing the process purely through the prism of probation as it has operated to date, as an evaluatory process. If you see it through that prism, then a lot of what follows does make an awful lot of sense, and understandably so, but that's not what we're about. We are not asking the profession to do the inspectorate's job as has happened heretofore. We are asking the profession to actually lead a complete reimagining of the process of induction for newly qualified teachers that supports them, guides them and challenges them.
But still, a tough decision needs to be made from time to time, that maybe somebody has got through a college and maybe they're just not suited for the profession, and it might be doing themselves an injustice and doing certainly learners an injustice to leave them there.
Absolutely. I think there are some teachers you will talk to and say they are chomping at the bit for this chance to actually exercise that judgment. They will see perhaps some case, they will argue, they will see cases where inspectors have come in, for example, into schools, and, for example, where I know in a Deshband 1 school, the NQT was preparing for the probationary visit, the teachers in the school sat down, did a DRAID type process, even when DRAID didn't exist, and said, look, here's the approaches we use in our classes with these kids, you might want to try them out for when the inspector comes in. And the NQT said very clearly, no, I know from talking to my NQT colleagues in other schools exactly what the inspector wants, I'm going to give the inspector what they want. Now, that may or may not be a very unfair judgment on the inspector concerned, but it's certainly a very unfair reflection on the status that should be accorded to the professional judgment of teachers. And I think that's the key point in all of this. That yes, the decision needs to be there is a confirmation of a readiness for full registration. From a very technical legal point of view, the PST in the school recommends to the council they are ready for registration. But the actual formal decision of confirming that full registration is made by the council. And it's the first thing to bear in mind. And second of all, in those tricky cases, the 2 to 5% I referred to a few moments ago, there are in the pilot, as it stands certainly, very clear built-in supports that they will not find themselves on their own. If they feel ready to make that judgment on their own, the RIT pilot makes ample scope for that. If, on the other hand, they're in the position you're talking about, they just feel really uncomfortable and say, look, we're doing our best. They're not really up to the mark as far as we're concerned, but I feel very awkward making that call. They have the NIPT on hand, the associates, and if they still don't feel comfortable making the decision in that very difficult case, then the inspector is prepared to come in the here and now. We would hope over time, as the pilot beds down, as it becomes mainstreamed in the future, and as it evolves, that the profession's confidence will grow. But we're not planning to rush into this or push the profession down this road sooner than they're ready for it either. But nevertheless, there does need to be kind of steady incremental progress in the whole evolution of the process.
Is it the case at the moment, Tomás, that teachers who are not registered with the Teaching Council will not be paid?
Yes, since Section 30 came into effect, I should say, in January early this year, the provisions of the section say that all teachers working in recognised schools must be registered with the Teaching Council in order to be paid salary from public funds.
Okay, and that's fully in place now.
So that's fully in place.
If I don't have a Teaching Council registration number, then I won't be paid.
Correct. And there have been a small number of cases where teachers, either for whatever reason, have let the registration lapse. And we try and get them back on the register as quickly as we can when they make contact. But for the period of time, it could be a couple of days. Sometimes it's in a very rare case, it can be a couple of weeks. For so long as they're not registered, they cannot be paid and they lose that pay.
You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. My guest on the programme this week is Tomás O'Rourke, who is Director of the Teaching Council. A topic that often arises in relation to professional accreditation bodies is fitness to practice. I asked Tomás if the legislation was now in place to conduct investigations into allegations of misconduct against teachers.
There is the Part 5 of the Teaching Council Act relates to fitness to teach and has not yet been commenced. And people will recall, I think back in January, that the Minister of the time, Rory Quinn, announced that they were intending to bring an amending legislation to bring the provisions of fitness to teach up to date, if you like, with similar provisions for nurses and for doctors. So that legislation, as we understand it, has continued to be progressed through inside the department, has not yet been published. Our understanding is that they intend to publish it fairly soon, I think this side of Christmas, and hopefully then get it enacted as quickly as possible, get it commenced as quickly as possible. We are certainly gearing up our preparations for it in terms of making sure all the relevant documentation, procedures and so on, regulations are in place in advance. We are also obviously recruiting staff to head up the team. I think the key point about fitness to teach, and this is as much for the public as for the profession, is that international experience of regulation across many professions will indicate that it tends to, I suppose, zero in or focus in about 1% of the registering population. And I think that people may see that as a reassurance. People may be worried about that it's as low as 1% depending on your perspective. I think the important point, therefore, to remember is that fitness to teach must be seen by everybody, teachers and public alike, as one element of the whole standards enhancement process that the Teaching Council is doing as a professional standards body. So if you, as a regulator from Ontario for pharmacists, pointed out, you know, the opposite of competency is not incompetency, it's disinterest. Like the opposite of love is not hate, but boredom. And he was saying that, you know, to focus on the regulatory aspect only of any regulator is to miss the point of the 99%. That if you look at the narrative and the discourse, I think, certainly in education in Ireland, across our policy documentation, that of the department, there's a very clear strand running throughout it all of genuinely, authentically looking at or focusing in on excellence for all children, all teachers. And that if you simply rest your quality assurance on the fitness to practice piece only, and it zeroes in on 1%, all the children have been taught by the remaining 99%. So how do you go about maintaining and enhancing the standards of their teaching through entry criteria, through accreditation, which is teacher education, induction probation and CPD?
So what you're really saying then is the fitness to teach is kind of the last resort if it gets to that stage.
Correct. I think it's important to acknowledge that teachers being people are going to encounter professional difficulties at some stage during their career. I think it's also important to acknowledge that the system has many supports in place that teachers can avail of to help them address those difficulties. I think it's only really in situations where teachers, in spite of those supports being available, not being able to address those difficulties satisfactorily, that's where you begin to look at the space of fitness to practice, I think.
And what kind of matters matters do you envisage could come before the Teaching Council's Fitness to Teach Committee?
I think it's going to be one we're going to have to watch very carefully, because we have to be, the legislation point charges us with taking due account of what they call local procedures or local processes in schools, namely Section 24 of the 1998 Education Act, that's a disciplinary process, and also Section 28 of the Act referring to grievance procedures. That section has not yet been commenced as far as I'm aware. And the Act says that except where there is good and sufficient reason to do otherwise, we should allow those processes to unfold before we would hear a complaint. Now, you can imagine very serious cases, like, for example, like child abuse might be one, where even if there's a local process unfolding at school level, fitness to practice could still take place in relation to that. So I think the grounds currently set out relate, for example, to the Code of Professional Conduct, and where teachers' behaviour seem to be falling short, or seriously short, I think it is, of the standards that could be reasonably expected of a registered teacher. That's where the fitness to practice process would come into play. And if you look at perhaps, some of the examples we would have seen in other teaching councils like Wales and Scotland, where we've attended hearings as part of our preparations for Part 5, some of the cases we would have seen relate to inappropriate communications, for example, between teachers and colleagues sometimes, and teachers and pupils as well, or also perhaps teachers physically restraining pupils and cases like that. But obviously, the way the process unfolds in our situation here in Ireland, we'll have to take account of the context of our own code of professional conduct.
So have you any idea at this stage what a hearing would look like?
We have some idea from obviously the experience of the teaching councils. I think it's important, I suppose, to the impression I would have formed from observing hearings in other teaching councils is that the process is as fair as it possibly could be to all concerned, including the teacher. Sometimes the teacher chooses to be represented, sometimes they choose not to be represented, sometimes the teacher chooses not to attend, even though they might be advised strongly to do so. I would have observed the chair of disciplinary hearings and other teaching councils making sure, particularly in the case, one case I remember where a teacher was not represented, making sure, absolutely sure, the teacher understood at each stage of the process what was happening, did they contest the charges and so on and so forth, because the legal advisor that's engaged or retained by the disciplinary panel is charged with the responsibility of both the looking after the panel's interests and kind of making sure they understand the legal context in which they're operating, but also making sure that they're fair to the teacher concerned and to the complainant. So they're supposed to be a legal advisor to the process rather than a legal advisor as such to the council as a body corporate, if you like. So that's the sense I have of it in terms of how the hearings will unfold.
And is it a public process in those countries generally?
The default position in Scotland and in Wales is public, and obviously they can take representations from all parties to the case if they wish to have all or part of the hearing in private. And sometimes they do that. I think particularly, obviously, where you're taking evidence from minors, children or vulnerable adults, I think the default position in that situation would be that they're taken in camera or by video link and so on. Our Act is silent on the matter of whether it's public or private, and our legal advice that we've got on that matter indicates that unless the Act is amended, the default position will be private by default. And the Council's position on that is that we would prefer to have a clear legal provision for deciding in each case whether to hold all or part of the hearing in private or in public. And we feel that would be more appropriate for the stage at which the fitness to practice process would be in Ireland, considering it's commencing for the first time here.
I suppose a teacher might be concerned that if they were called to a hearing that they would almost be assumed to be guilty whether they were found to be so or not.
Mm.
So how do you think you could avoid that if there was a public element to it? Or
I think it's going to be a process that we'll have to manage very carefully. We understand teachers will be anxious about this, and I think any teacher will find themselves in the position of fitness to practice hearing will be understandably very anxious and concerned about the process and the public and private element of it. I think this is where we have to, I suppose, acknowledge that there are a number of parties whose rights are competing or certainly have to be included in the process, namely the complainant could be a parent or a pupil. Certainly parents or pupils will be involved, their interests will be involved in the case, because it's all about the quality of teaching and learning for parents and for children, obviously, and for students and learners. There's obviously the rights of the teacher to fair due process and good name and so on. I think my understanding of the legal system in a broader context is that justice must not only be done but be seen to be done. And I think there, even if a hearing was held, for example, all or part in public, some of the other regulators and the teaching councils are beginning to go down the road of anonymisation of names and so on, so that somebody can walk in and observe the hearing, but in terms of the publication of the proceedings and so on, all names will be anonymised. Now, the council still hasn't confirmed its position on that, because obviously we're awaiting the amendments to the Act in the amending bill to come. And depending on what the amendments make provision for, we'll then have to refine our procedures around that. But I think there, we are certainly very acutely aware of concerns around the public-private hearing issue, and we're keen to make sure that we are, as I suppose, as sensitive as possible to the concerns and rights of all in the process.
On another topic, Tomás, teacher supply. Does the Teaching Council have a role in monitoring the supply of teachers in Ireland?
Our role is set down in the Act. It's quite clearly kind of circumscribed, if you like, in terms of advising the Minister on the issue of teacher supply, full stop. I do recall, I think, from the Oireachtas debates that one of the drafts of the bill proposed at one point, the original Teaching Council Act, proposed that we advise on supply and demand, but demand was removed in the final Act. So that's the legal position as it currently stands. I think people may or may not be aware that the Council recently approved a roadmap for providing advice that has been requested by the Minister of Education on the matter of teacher supply. And that roadmap includes two main strands. One is the establishment of a technical working group, which will include ourselves, the Department of Education and Skills, and the Higher Education Authority, chaired by an independent chair, Ciarán Flynn, recently retired from the ACCS, and also has Professor Áine Hyland as an expert education advisor on it as well. And that's our remit in the terms of reference that were approved by the Council for that group. So its main goal is to provide advice, draft advice to the Council, that it will then consider and amend or accept as appropriate before forwarding that advice to the Minister. That's strictly speaking the pathway for all of this. The second strand, before I come to suppose to further clarification of that, is the establishment of a consultative forum, which will be quite large. Every institution or organisation, every HEI, every union, every management body that has an interest, a valid interest in the matter of teacher supply, can send two representatives to this consultative forum, at which it will discuss proposals emerging from the technical working group and offer feedback on those, and also other issues that are considered relevant to the matter of teacher supply that perhaps have not been considered by the technical working group. The consultative forum can also offer advice and feedback on those that the technical working group will then take on board and bear in mind in its deliberations. What we have said quite clearly as a council, I think, is that, yes, we're preparing advice for the council and ultimately for the department and all of this. The terms of reference for the technical working group talk in terms of one of the most important outcomes will be a process as opposed to an outcome. We're planning to pilot a model that might conceivably help manage this issue of teacher supply on a sustainable, ongoing, structured basis into the future. At the moment, we have no standing forum for discussing teacher supply. So we are dependent on the issue flaring up due to a shortage, as has happened in the past, or at the moment, people perceive that there is an excess of supply. It's more complicated than that. There's 89,000 teachers in the register. We know there are NQTs experiencing difficulties getting employment or getting full employment. But equally, there is an undersupply in certain subjects of post-primary. Irish being a very clear case in point, for example. So it's not as simple as people might think on first hearing. And I think certainly we would argue in terms of emerging from the crisis we've come from the last 5 or 6 years, like so many other issues, you can try and go for a neat, quick fix solution, which probably will not work. Or you can try and take your time and think about it and say, what kind of structure is needed to manage this process, not just in the here and now, but periodically every 3 or 4 years into the future? One example being, for example, Scotland. And Scotland itself would say its model is not perfect, and people in Scotland criticise their model, but they do have a system for trying to deal with the issue.
And when do you think there might be some information available, say, on projections or anything like that?
The technical working group is charged with providing and then preparing an interim report that will go to the minister before the end of the year. Now, how when that's published, I think it'll be a matter for the department. People who are nominating representatives to the consultative forum will obviously begin to get a kind of a wind of where the thinking is going at the first meeting of the consultative forum, for example. So I think will begin to emerge at that point in time. We are obviously, as in all areas of our work, will be conscious of the need to kind of manage the communications very appropriately on this one. But there are a lot of, I suppose, sensitivities and the context around this. We don't want to kind of, I suppose, rush kind of headlong into it either. The terms of reference of the technical working group say that it should complete its work within 1 year from the date of its first meeting that took place earlier this month. So we have it till October next year, I think, to complete the process of preparing the advice. Obviously, we'd like to see the advice forwarded as promptly as possible to the department, and we'd like to see a successful outcome to the advice as soon as possible after that.
I'm always shocked when I read articles about teaching in the United States about how almost 50% of those who begin teaching leave it within the first 5 years. Mm. Do we have any data on
the attrition rates of teachers in Ireland?
I'm not aware, as I speak to you now, of there may well be. My sense of it is that the attrition rates are not as high as they would be in certain other teacher education pathways in other countries. What the bigger difficulty we have, I think, as we referred to in the previous question, is the issue of NQTs either being unemployed or underemployed. And we are aware from discourse online and so on, discussions online, that you know that's having a negative impact on the attractiveness of the profession to people looking at their CEO options every year and so on. I think there's certainly very clear data that indicates that the points level is dropping in very small amounts, but nonetheless has been consistently dropping for the last 3 or 4 years. The point system is a crude indicator at best. It's about supply and demand rather than inherent quality. But nevertheless, insofar as there is a decreasing demand for teaching, however small it may be, that is an issue of concern to us. And through things like FAILCH and so on, and through our work in teacher supply, in both those very different strands of work, we are trying to show we are acutely aware of the issue and are doing our best to address it within our remit.
And finally, Tomás, you're now 2.5 years into the position. Mm. If you were to look back over the last 2.5 years, what would you say is your greatest achievement, or what are you most proud that you've done over the last 2.5 years, and what are you looking forward to at this stage?
Oh God, there's a $6 million question. I suppose we could answer in a third middle way. I think what is striking me the most now. If you'd asked me 2.5 years ago, you know, what teacher's professionalism means or should mean, I probably would have started in terms of teacher's teaching. And I've come to realise, I mean, I love the learning in the job. One of the achievements I'm most proud of is that we're trying to, I suppose, clearly and visibly learn, model our learning as an organisation. That the typical view of a body like the Teaching Council is you are the statutory regulator, you must know exactly what you're doing, you must put out very clear direction and instruction, you set the standards, you must give the seal of approval, and that's it. And any kind of, you know, wishful thinking out loud or exploring, reflecting, that's not what a professional statutory regulator does. But that's precisely what a body like the Teaching Council should do. And I think that we've been doing that, and people are responding to it. Not everyone likes it, and not everyone gets the message we're trying to get across, but we are beginning to turn the tide by counterintuitively trying to repitch the understanding of teachers' professionalism in terms of their learning as much as, not instead of, but as much as their teaching. So that's probably kind of the biggest achievements. It's a nebulous one, but I think it's probably one of the most important ones. Looking ahead, I think definitely the research issue has come in the last 6 months forefront in my thinking. It just has hit me between the two eyes that teachers rightly, I think, bemoan the PISA tornado that hits our shores periodically, the TALIS tornado, whatever it may be. And I would love to see, building on that kind of achievement I've just referred to, there's many others I could talk about, but I know time is limited. I would love to see the profession's voice become the prevailing wind in the discourse. I think, you know, I'm no geographer, but you look at the landscape in Ireland in particular, the West Coast, you look at the trees that are slanted by the winds. Storms will come and storms will go, but it's the prevailing winds have the most significant impact on the landscape. And I think if we actually get the profession to realise the opportunities that we are offering them to lead their own learning and lead their own professional conversations before someone else tries to take it away, I think we will achieve incredible outcomes for everybody. And I mean teachers as learners, children as learners, parents as learners. There is great cause for hope, I think, for the future if we get the research piece right.
And on that hopeful note, I bring this evening's Inside Education to a close. Thanks to my guest, Tomás O'Rourke, for his time. If you'd like to feature an idea or an event on a future programme, you can write to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. You can listen to almost 200 podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.